in order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from that heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all our steps on the paths of omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this.
Hey, good evening. Nice hot weather. Maybe we go through Mi Palm's little summary of the schools at the beginning, and then we'll look at the handout that focuses in on some of the weird terminology, some of the terms that are sort of key and very unusual. And then we go through the homework assignment. So on page 55 of the source book, Mi Palm's presentation of the summary of the earlier traditions, what he calls the Shravakas, where he combines the Vaibhashikas and the Sautrantikas and points out the common points that apply to both, and then he'll go through them separately. But I thought it made a nice little, both in length and content, condensation of the basics, the basic grounds of common agreed upon tenets that all Buddhist schools basically start with. So on page 55 we have his beginning of his text, which is called The Summary of Philosophical Systems by Mipham Gyatso. We don't have his name here, but that's the dude that wrote this. And he says, the Buddhist philosophical systems that are to be accepted comprise the Hinayana and the Mahayana. The Hinayana, according to the gradation, is in intellectual capacity, consists of Shravakayana and Pratyeka Buddhayana. The Shravakayana is discussed here according to the school's character and philosophical tenets. And then if you read, anybody read Gunther's preface? Was that any good? Was that okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He can be okay then, right? he says, there's a major division in Buddhism known as Hinayana Mahayana. These two appellations are used to indicate attitudinal rather than philosophical differences. Mahayana refers to a socially oriented attitude. Hinayana to an individualistically oriented one.
It's kind of true, though. That's kind of a good characterization of it.
Yeah. And then at the end he says, however, Kuncho Jingme Wangpo makes it clear that a particular social attitude does not necessarily coincide with a certain philosophical belief. And one school or another can be as selfish as any other. He also touches on Vajrayana, which is nice. So back to Mr. Gyatso. The Shravakayana is discussed here according to schools, characteristics, character or characteristics, and philosophical tenets. There were 18 schools. In the beginning, there were the Mahasamgikas and the Staviras. So first he says there's the traditional 18, and those arose from the two main roots, which were the Mahasamgikas and the Staviras. The Staviras split up into the blah blah blahs, and the Shravakas split up into the Heimlich maneuvers and so forth. And they had different views. All of them had been refuted in the main work, from which the following is an excerpt. The character, Shravakas observe impeccable manners and abolish all positive and negative imputations concerning the knowable, which is analyzed by them into the psychophysical constituents, which is a translation of what term, do you think?
Dhatus or
dharmas?
The parts, the partless particles.
No. But look, there's the triad, the psychophysical constituents, the elements, and the interactional fields.
Ayatanas and dhatus, no?
I think the ayatanas are the elements, and the dhatus are the interactional fields. So what's the other member of that triad of the three skills?
The skandhas.
The skandhas. Thank you, Barbara. Welcome back. Those are the three skills, right? We know the four noble truths, but also the three skills, skandhas, ayatanas, and dhatus. Basic things that all Buddhists should know about, that are the core, the foundation for understanding wisdom, for understanding and developing wisdom. The three skills. We should be skilled in those topics. What are they? How do they function? How do they relate?
What was the third one?
Dhatus. By studying and pondering over the four truths in every possible way and in a faultless manner. Impeccable manners. Like Don Juan, right? The warrior should be impeccable, right? When they're reviled, angered, beaten, or irritated, they do not retaliate in any way. They possess the four qualities marking a religious person. I wish I had the notes, because I don't know what those are. Four qualities marking a religious person. It might be the four limitless attitudes of loving kindness and so forth, the four immeasurables. And with them, they set out on the path, capitalized. Further, they have few desires, but they have those few are very strong. No, just kidding. They have few desires and know how to be content. They observe the 12 practices that mark a scrupulous person. I wish I had that. And they are moderate in eating. Try not to sleep during the first and last parts of the night. The night has three watches. The first one is 8 to 12. The second is 12 to 4. And the third is 4 to 8. So they try not to sleep only much. So they sleep only 4 hours, 12 to 4. And they practice the 37 topics conducive to enlightenment over the five paths by properly meditating on the ugly duckling or swan or whatever. You know the 37 aspects of the path to enlightenment, right? And they meditate on the ugly and other aspects of things as the antidote against the three poisons. So what is the meditating on ugliness the antidote to?
Attachment,
desire. What's the antidote to anger? Aggression.
Loving kindness.
Loving kindness, yeah. And what's the antidote to ignorance?
Wisdom.
More specifically.
Discriminating.
Like a topic.
Emptiness.
Close.
Mental life.
The antidote to ignorance.
In this scheme, yeah. Or, you know, ignorance in this sense is not fundamental ignorance. Ignorance here is stupidity, or bewilderment, or prejudice, as it's now translated.
Equanimity.
Equanimity.
Study.
Interdependence. Dependent origination. So knowing that things arise in dependence on other things, and thereby overcoming the ignorance that thinks, you know, the world is out to get me, and all sorts of things like that. work on the four truths, and again, on the chain here, from the Donners, instead of just the concept of interdependence here, it's the chain of interdependent originations, the 12-fold. Thereby, they reach their goal, deliverance from the three worlds, being desire, form, and formless worlds, right? Since both their paths and the deliverances reached by them are something positive, they must not be discarded. And since also in Mahayana these lower paths and deliverances are commonly accepted as being necessary for the higher reaches, they are not to be looked down upon. However, the petty selfishness and the philosophical belief that what is only a partial aspect of the ground, the path, and the goal is something existing in an ultimate sense is what is going to be refuted in the Mahayana. Scathing critiques of the Hinayana, right? So what are they? Petty selfishness. That may be a mistranslation, you know, right? Sort of a focus on selfish, selflessness. Self-interest. One's own salvation, right? Individual salvation or liberation, as we say. A focus on individual liberation. And then the philosophical belief that things exist in an ultimate sense. And that's the main topic for today's class, is the views of the Vaibhashika. We're going into that school next week, and the main thing is that everything exists substantially and self-sufficiently.
That's interesting if that is a criticism of the Hinayana, because everything we've been talking about is to understand the different ways of the different schools examine the nature of reality, and the one isn't higher than the other. We can understand better if we start with the earlier and simpler ways of, or as you would say, clunky, coarser ways. And so, wouldn't you think that it would be the same thing in understanding those attitudes of the Hinayana?
That's
a foundation.
Well, it's a balance. You know, he did start the paragraph by saying that you got to start with them, that they are the foundation. But then from there, you got to see what's lacking.
So that's what it's doing.
Yeah.
Not really criticism. But it's sometimes, like you said, it's the translation that makes it
sound like pejorative. Yeah. Their philosophical tenets are listed in two groups, those which are common to them, discussed below, and then the individual philosophical systems, which are discussed later. The Shravakas have 7 points in common. Since their lower paths must be transcended, they must be known here in the Mahayana, because it has been said that to transcend is to know and to see with open eyes. We can't go further or more deeply unless we know what's in the shallow end of the pool, and so forth. 7 points are that the four truths exist as objective realities. Suffering and so forth is an objective reality. Atoms and moments are the ultimate objective realities, the ultimate builders of the universe. Atoms, partless particles, and moments of consciousness. Arhatship is the final goal. There's nothing beyond that. They do not recognize a primal ground, Vajra nature. They do not recognize the Mahayana teachings and sutras. The non-recognition of the 10 bhumis, which was an interesting little point that came up in one of the readings, where although in the Hinayana traditions they accept that the Buddha, well, actually he'll explain these in detail, and then the claim that the Buddha is merely an individual human being, just a Joe guy like you and I. So let's go through them in detail. These are John Doe, right? These are the truths of frustration, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. The first relates to the psychophysical constituents, which is a translation of the skandhas, representing affectively toned and affect-arousing effect. So this is like kleshas, right? Klesha and karma. Karma and kleshas. affectively toned would be karma, and affect arousing would be klesha. It includes all the sentient beings as they are born in the six kinds of life forms, as well as their environments, the external, so-called external world. These four truths are the embodiment and presence, or resting place, of frustration, because among these beings, three kinds of misery are encountered. What are the three kinds of suffering?
What's the suffering of suffering?
Suffering of suffering is one.
Suffering of alternation.
Suffering of alternation is two.
And then all pervasive suffering.
Yeah, all pervasive is three. So suffering of suffering is physical and psychological bummerness, unhappiness. Suffering of change is the impermanence. Things are constantly shifting. Even if you get comfortable with things being bad, then it changes. And then all pervasive. It's like constant level of underlying level of uncertainty and anxiety. Origin means the cause of this frustration and this karmic action and emotive responses. Karmic actions are motivations, perceptions, and that which has been set up by motivation, i.e. acts by body and mind, speech. Each of them is good, evil, and neutral. Emotive responses are passion, lust, and the others. The others being
envy,
jealousy, aggression, stupidity, the five big pleasures. Let's see. Cessation means that frustration, together with its cause, has ceased to operate. It is twofold. The psychophysical constituents still being present, i.e. when you become enlightened, still are alive, and then there being no more, as in passing away, as an enlightened person. The path to this cessation of frustration is the application of what is termed the five paths in one's life, so as to realize the cessation of frustration by eliminating its cause through being aware of frustration. Being aware of frustration is the fundamental aspect of the path. Two, since individual atoms as ultimate and primary factors in the physical universe and individual moments of the primary instances of the flux of cognition exist in an ultimate sense, it is claimed that they build the physical world and its cognition. So this is a tenet that's common to these lower schools. Very materialistic, so to speak, if you consider that mind, you know, is real in the sense that matter for us is real. For them, mind and matter are very real. An arhat who has passed into a state where the psychophysical constituent skandhas are no more does not relapse into the world because the cause for being born in the three worlds has lost its generating power. There is no Buddhahood because one is tied to the Shravaka pattern. It is claimed that passing into nirvana is like a flame going out when the oil has been consumed. What is the significance of the last point? It is claimed that passing into nirvana is like a flame going out when the oil has been consumed.
Is that like you can't attain enlightenment unless you die?
No, that was the first part. The whole thing of there being... that was actually up above where he said there was two types of enlightenment, one with the aggregate still existing and one without. And that the full, final enlightenment is after you die. But this idea that nirvana is like a flame going out when the oil has been consumed has two parts of it. One is that there's no next moment in that continuum, because all the productive factors have been burned up. So there's no next moment in the continuum of an arhat after they die. And the other significance is that there's no rebirth as like a bodhisattva. There's no sense of choosing your next rebirth or continuing to exist to help others. It's just totally gone. There's nothing that's gone. It's just the end of the fiction. When the six groups of perceptions are recognized, no common ground for their operation is accepted because it does not constitute an objective reference. I'm sorry, so I said Vajra nature. It's actually Alaya Vijnana that's being talked about here. They do not accept the Alaya Vijnana. So in terms of there being six senses, there's no common ground for their operation because it does not constitute an objective reference. Moreover, such a ground is said to be inadmissible, the Alaya Vijnana, because if there were static mind serving as the ground of everything, it would have to be an individual self. So they don't like the Alaya Vijnana because of a smack of self. Five, when the four sections of the Vinaya and the other scriptures of the Hinayana rather are considered to be the Buddha's words while they are, the Prajnaparamita literature is not so considered because, as they say, this literature has been composed by Mara and outsiders in order to proselytize them because they seem to contradict the Tripitaka and the four axioms. What are the four axioms?
Four truths?
In this sense, in this case, I think it is... I don't know. He translated four truths, so it's probably the four marks
of existence.
Yeah.
Impermanence and stuff.
Yeah. Some people translate the four truths as axioms. Six. So this is one of their most dangerous ones, that they denigrate the Mahayana teachings and the sutras of the Mahayana, which is really a very dangerous thing to do. Six, when one sees the truths, cannot stay in samsara for many aeons more, as the Bodhisattva does. A highly gifted individual who, on the level of an ordinary person, is capable of accumulating merits and knowledge during three countless aeons, has the power to thereby become a Buddha. That person will realize the factors conducive to and forming part of enlightenment during one session. So this is the whole issue that we went through in the course on the history of Buddhism, where they talk about what is the view of the Buddha's enlightenment. And Hinayana Shravakayana view is that he was a normal person when he sat down that last night after 6 years of asceticism, and he went from the path of accumulation to the path of preparation, seeing, meditation, into no more learning, and that one whole night, even though he had spent aeons accumulating merit. He was still a regular Joe Schmidt. Some highly gifted persons who for countless aeons have been able to endure hardships and samsara will become Buddhas when they have studied the Shravaka paths and accumulated merits and knowledge during these aeons. Others are not capable of doing so because frustration in the world is overwhelming and because malicious elements, i.e. Mara, prevent them from working for others and being only focused on their own liberation. Therefore, while Buddha means the sublime individual, it does not mean authenticity, nirmanakaya. Interesting translation of nirmanakaya. So just notice, it does not mean nirmanakaya because an individual Buddha still has the residue of what is going to mature, inasmuch as he bleeds and feels pain in the back. So because he said that he had these experiences of backache and he bled at one point, therefore he's viewed as having an abnormal body and not the dharmakaya or the nirmanakaya body of the Buddha. There also is no continual concentration. In the Mahayana tradition, we view the Buddha as being continually in samadhi, that he's continually in the meditative state of equipoise on the nature of reality. And in the Shravaka school, they don't think so. They think that when he's in meditation, the Buddha after he attained enlightenment, when he's in meditation, he's in equipoise upon the nature of reality. But when he's not, when he's out of it, he's not much different from other people. There's no continual concentration because it's said in the scriptures that he came out of a state of deep concentration and then went for alms. So that's how it's described. So he left the state of samadhi and did X, Y, or Z. So this is one of the almost all of these are a case of a difference in interpretation of the teachings of the Buddha, where the Buddha says certain things, and you can either interpret them literally, as yeah, he said, I arose from that samadhi and I went about in my day and I began my day. I washed and I placed put on my robes and I went and got almost. And because of, he said he came out of samadhi, therefore the Buddha is not continually in samadhi, he came out of it. And the Mahayana tradition says, well, there was a phrase, he didn't really mean that, he meant that he was no longer sitting in samadhi, but he is in continual samadhi as he goes about whatever he does, but it doesn't look like he's in samadhi, it's not formal, whatever. They also claim that after the Buddha had passed into nirvana, his working for others stopped completely. So even though he made a vow of the bodhisattva that after his Buddhahood lifetime, he enters parinirvana and no longer exists in any way, according to the Shravaka. So then we have Nipam's critique, which is really a great part of Nipam's version, is that we have the critique of those points. The four truths do not exist as ultimate realities because they are found nowhere when one examines the whole of the given, the world and its inhabitants, and the psychophysical, the skandhas, and the dhatus, and because all that is termed rejection, acquisition, riddance, and possession are indexes, not entities. So this is referring to the first part is just saying, is based upon the conclusion that partless particles is impossible. Partless moments of consciousness is an impossibility. So they can't actually exist in the way they're described. And then these terms, rejection, acquisition, and so forth, those are what are called the non-association. Those are in the group of entities called the non-associated formations. Hey, we have a little handout tonight. Thank you. I have to circulate the electrical version. Or the digital version.
They're formation. They're named formations.
They're in the formations, the 51 mental formations. But they're not. They're in the non-associated section of that. So we'll go over that when we do the handout in a few moments. And two, there are no atoms building the physical world. So going back over number one again in more detail. So we're on page 57, upper left. Number two, if they did, they would have to meet each other partially or totally. If they met in the former case, they would not be indivisible in as much as they would have parts. And if in the latter case, if they met totally, a whole closed system would become an atom. Hence, they cannot exist as builders in the universe. If they would build a world without meeting each other, atoms of darkness and light could enter the spaces in between them, and still other atoms could enter into the spaces in between the latter, so that into a small grain, 3,000 atoms or more could enter. That's a scary number, 3,000. Atoms are also not found when one investigates shadows, distances, and arrows being shot. This is a little obscure reference to I'm not sure about shadows, but there's this thing about shadows that I can't remember. But with distances and the arrow being shot, it's the Greek thing as well. It that how does an arrow ever reach its target? Because first it goes halfway there, and it goes the other another halfway there, and it keeps going halfway of the remaining distance, and that can be divided up infinitely, so it never actually hits the target, right?
Nagarjuna talks about that.
Nagarjuna. Time moments also do not exist as such. The problem is whether the middle moment joins the previous moment, the beginning moment, and whether in subsequent moments or not. In the former case, it would have to do so by degrees or all at once. If it does it by degrees, moments are divisible. So if not indivisible moments, and if they do so all at once, even an am becomes a single time moment. All time would condense into one moment. Cough would stop. If time moments did not join, that which is in between them can be interrupted by other time moments, just like any other time period would come in. This latter time moment either comes in between other time moments or it does not. If it does not, one can not know duration as an addition of time instances. And if it does come in between, the indivisibility of time moments becomes untenable. Arhatship is not final nirvana because the obscurations of the various patterns of existence have not yet been completely removed. And they do talk about obscurations, as we'll see, because the radiant light, which is the very nature of mind, is what constitutes Buddhahood. How do you like that one? That might have been helpful for the homework assignment, right? Because the obscurations are incidental, they're not inherent. If they were inherent, you could never get rid of them. So they're incidental, meaning they're not inherent. Because even if the activity of mentation may be stopped while the obscurations have not yet been removed, the cause for projecting a mind existence is still there. And because the two prerequisites as the cause for final enlightenment must be acquired. The two prerequisites as the cause for final enlightenment are what? The accumulations of
merit.
A primal ground, Aliya Vishnana, must be accepted because if it did not exist, continuity would not be possible. Neither could one be born in samsara nor be liberated from it because there would be no substratum. The tendencies moving in either direction, and when there is no mind in which the six perceptive functions operate, the mind could not come into operation again, because when the functions have been stopped, there's nothing from which they might start again. So if you go into the trance of neither perception nor non-perception, where there's no mind functioning, how can you then wake up and have the same personality and the same memories and the same think that you're the same person? There was no sort of unconscious ground of our human mental activity. Or when you go to sleep, or when you become unconscious, or go in a coma, and you wake up. It's a little cold in here. Can we turn the guy down a little bit? Is that possible, John?
Can I have a chair?
Oh, you want some tissues? For sure. Anybody else?
So the primal ground isn't some essence.
No, it isn't. It's just Aliya Vishnana. It's a funny translation. Why does it say primal ground? And as we'll see later, not all of the Mahayana schools accept the primal ground. So it's a little bit odd, or it's sort of interesting. It reveals Nipam's slant in that he's presenting it here. Let's see. So there would be no substratum for the tendencies moving in either direction. When there is no mind in which the six perceptive functions operate, a mind could not come into operation again out of coma or with samadhi of neither perception or non-perception, in which cases the functions have been stopped. And there's nothing from which they might start again. Moreover, if it is a fact that the whole of appearance is of the nature of experience, referring to which tenet system?
Sautantrika.
Either Sautantrika or Chittamantra, the ephemeral perceptive functions cannot be the cause of the possible experiences. So this is referring to that the Alivijnanas, the storehouses, is the cause for perceptive experiences. The ephemeral blips of our sense apparatus alone don't provide a viable explanation of what we perceive. Hence one must assume a common substratum or a primal ground. So here, sort of distinguishing two different types. The rejection of five, the rejection of the Mahayana is not admissible. Not only does the Mahayana not contradict the Tripitaka and the four axioms, it is even superior to the earlier teaching, because in the Hinayana, the path to Buddhahood is incomplete, while in the Mahayana, the path culminates in the most sublime goal of enlightenment. Six, there are the 10 spiritual levels. Even if one is set out on the noble path, the prerequisites must be prepared, because there are many hindrances on the path due to the many emotional imbalances, and the prerequisites are not complete for goal attainment, are not complete in the level of ordinary persons, because they have not received the initiatory confirmations and empowerments. Wow. So here is, let's see. Introduction.
What did he say?
I'm sorry?
What did he say?
He said that read it last week. There was this description of how, in Hinayana view, there is the five paths that lead to Buddhahood. In the case of somebody who's an unusual person who's cultivated merit for many, many aeons, and that their difference is one of uprooting the two obscurations. So they have the Hinayana that has the notion of there being two obscurations, an obscuration to kleshas, which is what arhats uproot, and then the obscuration to omniscience, which Buddhas uproot. But they had a limited, it was in last week's reading, they had a limited understanding of omniscience, of being able to understand whatever comes in front of that mind, to be able to understand immediately whatever is presented, as opposed to the Mahayana understanding of omniscience as being understanding everything simultaneously. And there's no difference of whether it's presented or not to the mind. And the significance is that the arhats represent it's in the next reading. We've got to go to the next reading. So let me not spend more time trying to remember it. Let's see. Hence, the levels are not contradictory to the gradation of knowledge on the levels counteracting the 10 obscurations which have to be eliminated. This is a very convoluted reference to the difference in views on how the obstructions are eliminated over the course of the path of meditation. whether there's a gradual elimination of hindrances and of what types of hindrances. Difference, big difference in the Hinayana versus the Mahayana tradition in that. In the Mahayana tradition, the obscuration to omniscience is the elimination of the klesha, the knowledge obscuration, which believes in the true reality of the skandhas, dhatus, ayatanas, the dharmas. If the Buddha is merely a human being and if his working for others ceases with his passing and enter nirvana, as a result of this having removed the obscurations and ignorance, point number 7, such as ephemeral and merciless, such an ephemeral and merciless being cannot command any respect. If he checks out as soon as he's actually become capable of helping other sentient beings. He's, as a Buddha, you have all these special powers that make you able to really help other sentient beings. And if he just checks out at that point, after getting all that, all of those additional characteristics, it just doesn't make any sense. At the time of enlightenment, when the radiant light is felt to shine free from obscurations, the appearance of the Buddha, though he may be seen in different forms and shapes, according to the different states of his being, of the beings, is not some individualistic phenomenon. So the Buddha is not a thing. He's not like some entity. He's like out there. Okay, so now let's go to what is a person? And then I added, what is ignorance? Because I thought, might as well go for it.
Where are you
at? Let's see. What are tenants? What are schools? What is ignorance? What is a person? Person, it starts on page 26. Buddhist philosophers on the right-hand side use the word person more broadly than do most of us, since not only humans, but also animals and other beings of worlds we don't really see are also persons. But they also use the term in a special sense to designate that which is the most essential aspect of our individual beings. To put it another way, they ask, what is it about me that constitutes my personhood? What is really me? One way to answer this is to make an inventory. And doing an inventory, the Buddha spoke about the five aggregates of body and mind, categories into which he placed all the other elements, all these elements. But when we refer to the person or even me, just what among these factors is it? Am I my body, my mind, some combination of them? Problems immediately arise when we consider any of these possibilities. For both the body and mind change continuously, and some aspects of them may become absent. So this related to like who becomes enlightened, what becomes enlightened in your homework or something. How can I identify me with my body if I lose my arms or legs in an accident or fail to receive a mechanical, bionic organ or joint? How can I identify me with my memories if amnesia or Alzheimer's robs me of them? Am I whatever I'm thinking, moment to moment? Do I cease to exist if I'm not thinking, such as when I'm asleep or unconscious in a coma? What is me if I'm in a coma? So as we've seen at one point, the one point that differentiates Buddhist schools from non-Buddhists is that the latter, the non-Buddhists, tend to define a person as something that is the unchanging core of the body and the mind, but is different from either. So this sort of contradictory description, that it's the core of the body and mind, but it's different from them. It is emphatically not the body and not the mind. Religions that speak about the soul are generally referring to such an entity. For them, my soul is irreducibly me. From the moment of my conception to the moment of my death, and possibly also before and after my present life. The Buddhists begin with the rejection of all these entities and therefore must answer the question. So what does person refer to in some way that can rely upon the five aggregates and the mind? Is it not a question, as some have thought, of denying that the word person or self means anything at all? It is not. Selflessness has always meant the negation of some concept about the self rather than selfhood itself. Let's skip to the next paragraph. So given the existence of the five aggregates, the body, mind, or mind, about what should be regarded as the person? This is not a trivial question, since all of the Buddhist schools regard the person as that to which the seeds of intentional actions or karma are infused or attached. He said most, but we'll see. Therefore, they sought to identify something that would be present continuously to which karma could affiliate itself with. In a selfless world, how does karma work? Therefore, they sought to identify something that would be present continuously, which is not to say it would be unchanging. It only means that at all times there's something whose existence is not in death. So there's some continuity so that it can pass over, it can hand the football of karma from one moment of itself to the next moment of itself. Whereas if there's a gap, if it's not continuous, then they fumble the football, right? So one option is that it's the mere collection of the aggregates, just sort of like a conceptual conglomeration. There are many kinds of vaibhashikas, and this is one of the issues on which they disagree. However, most of them would say that the person is the mere collection of the five aggregates of body and mind, there being no substantially existent person. But we're going to come back to what the heck a substantially existent thing is, and so forth. What they mean by mere, as a mere collection, is also what is meant by not substantially existent. A person is something that comes to mind only in dependence on perceiving something else first. So in other words, the definition of substantially existent is that it comes to mind without dependence upon something else. You can actually experience it directly. And we'll come back to flesh that out. For instance, I cannot say that I have perceived a person until I have at least seen a body or heard a voice or seen some evidence of that person, like writing. The person then is whatever is used within the five aggregates as the basis for recognizing someone as a person. It is not, therefore, an independent category. On the right-hand side, we have another option, an inexpressible reality. The person is just, you can't freaking describe it. The Samatthiyas say that the person is an entity that, although it exists, cannot be said to be either the same as or as the five aggregates are different from them. It is inexpressible. That's the best one. It's neither the same nor different, and you just can't describe it. It's ineffable. Skipping to the next paragraph. This idea is in some ways close to the Prasangikas, for whom the person is also inexpressible in that way. But for Prasangikas, it is not a substantial entity, i.e. one with its own independent existence. It's just a conventional figment. Skipping, another one is the continuum of the aggregates. The Sautrantikas of certain types say that there's a significant problem with the notion of collection. And so they identify as the person the continuum or the stream, the mere succession of moments of the body and mind, as opposed to the collection of the aggregates, some conglomeration of them as being the person. They say here that it's the continuity of the aggregates that's the person, and that carries that football. The mental consciousness, skipping to the next one. The followers of Dharmakirti, who differ on other tenets, say that a subtle, neutral form of the mental consciousness, person, Aliyavijnana, the Dharmakirti system. And in Buddhism in general, generally there are six types of consciousness. In addition to the mental, which discriminates and cogitates, there are the five associated with the senses. This illusion seems to suffer the objection that the mental consciousness does not operate continuously, at least at times of unconsciousness. So how could the mental consciousness... They say, not an Aliyavijnana, but they say that there's that the mental consciousness itself has a subtle, neutral part that is continuous. And as the author is saying, well, the mental consciousness is not always continuous. So how can that be the person? Then the next one is subtle, neutral, mental consciousness, which is pretty much the same as the one before. This is not the conceptual mind, but a substratum without content. So the author's saying that the first mental consciousness continuum as being the person was a conceptual fabrication. But this is not the conceptual mind, but a substratum below it. Some subtle form of mental consciousness, but must always be present. It's a thought. It is thought, for consciousness does not arise by itself, but is caused. It cannot be caused by body, but must be caused by a previous moment of consciousness. And therefore, consciousness is a never-ending stream. Hence, there must be some kind of mental consciousness always present, even when we're in a coma. The last sentence says, this subtle consciousness cannot ordinarily be remembered, so the proof of its existence is merely that it is logically necessary. It's got to be there. It's got to be something that's the person.
What a cheat.
Yeah. It's got to be there, so it must exist.
Dumb.
The mind basis of all, the Chittamatra. So, that of the mind basis of all, the Aliyavijnana, a neutral, continuously operating consciousness with no other function than to hold the seeds of actions. Indeed, the karmic latencies and the mind basis of all are a single substantial entity. So, this is this odd thing about the Aliyavijnana, is that if you have an Aliyavijnana, are the karmic seeds that reside within it, are they different from or the same as the Aliyavijnana? If they're different from, you run into sort of logical problems and also sort of logistical problems. But if they're the same, you also have problems. So here he's saying, indeed, the karmic latencies and the mind basis of all are a single substantial entity. They are never found apart from one another and are different only conceptually. It's because we look at them from different points of view. They seem to be different, the latent tendencies and seeds and the actual substratum that holds them. Then finally we have the Prasangika's version of the person, the mere I. It's only me, mere me. Skipping a couple of sentences, the Prasanga consider all the possibilities mentioned above to be indefensible, since they are all based upon the assumption of the true existence of the person that when sought among the bases of designation, such as the mind and body, can be found. All the versions come with this preconception that there has to be one. So we got to find how to describe it in the best way.
Well, there's got to be a real one.
There's got to be something real that acts as the person that's the holder or container of the karmic seeds, of karma, that somehow functions to facilitate the transmission of karma. However, the assumption of the true existence of the person that when sought among the bases of designation, such as the skandhas and so forth, such as the mind and body, can be found. Rather, Prasangika said, an analytical search, a full Google search, will not result in the finding of anything that exists independently. All things are empty. Now, skipping to the next paragraph, the mere I is just that. The person is just a name. It's just a term. It's a handy reference. It's a nominal designation made on the basis of the aggregates, but it's not itself any of the aggregates. It's not the sum total of them. It's not any parts of them. As we saw in the last chapter, the various possibilities outlined above assume substantial existence. This is precisely what is wrong with each one of them. And then he talks about the transmission of karma. So how does it happen then that the karma is transmitted? So at the end of that first paragraph he says, there must be a continual basis for these latent tendencies, these latencies. Otherwise actions and their effects would not necessarily be related. Karma would be totally sporadic and erratic. So how do they each deal with this? At the end of this next, or the first paragraph on the page, it says the Vaibhashika schools introduce a factor called acquisition. You can purchase something, you can acquire your karma and put in your shopping cart, and the function of that is to attach the latencies of the continuum of the sentient being to the continuum of the sentient being who has acquired them. They're yours. Others refer to a factor called non-wastage of actions, meaning that the potency of the karma persists until the fruition, their fruition, without being wasted. So a slightly more subtle version where there's no clunkiness of like acquiring karmic tendencies of being two different entities, the acquire and the acquired, but somehow just the karmic tendencies themselves don't peter out. They have a certain momentum that necessarily is retained until they manifest. Let's see. In the case of other schools, no additional factors are mentioned, so on and so forth. The school considered the continuum of mind to be the basis of infusion, while the Chittamatrams and so forth use the idea of the mind basis of all. Prasangikas again criticize all these karmic seed holders because they are presented as substantially existent entities, as are the seeds themselves. They believe that it is not necessary to invent any of these possibilities. Rather, a fact about actions themselves, their disintegratedness, which requires neither intervening causes nor making actions into permanent entities, is responsible for the production of effects. Disintegratedness is not a very elegant term, but it refers to the state that exists once something has occurred and is now in the past. These Galukas explain at length how this state can then function to produce effect. So here we have an introduction of another way that karma might operate, and so they're trying to be very devious and slippery, and they say there's disintegratedness. It refers to the state that exists once something has occurred and now in the past, and is now in the past. So the non-presentness of an action has an entity to it. It's a thing in that it can perform a function. So this obviously has many logical problems too. So there's different groups within the Prasangikas that don't really like this explanation. This is Tsongkhapa's explanation. And if you remember that he had 8 difficult points of the Prasangika that he put forward, and he got some very vociferous complaints against all 8 and many people. Okay, so then we go through the best part, which is what is ignorance? So we go back a few pages because this got put in the wrong order. It was just a mistake. We go back to page 22. What is ignorance? So this was part of our homework, so why don't we pause here and see what people have as the answers to what is ignorance. Without getting into this, you have to close that. What is ignorance? Pete, what's ignorance?
I had that not knowing the true nature of reality.
So ignorance is not knowing the true nature of reality. So we're ignorant of the true nature of reality. And that's what causes samsara, that ignorance, right?
Yeah.
Anyone else? ignorances.
Belief in a separate self.
Belief in a separate self.
Duality, yeah, that was my other / duality.
Belief in a separate sense of self and duality. Ignorances.
Oh, ignorance is bliss. Delayed pain. Delayed suffering.
Brent, ignorance is.
Oh, it's when you don't know something.
It's when you don't know things.
Hey, buddy, go straight up.
It's when you don't know something.
Yeah.
That's what ignorance is. And so in this case, what do we not know? What are we ignorant of?
I guess, as people are saying, like our nature and the nature of reality.
The true nature of reality. And so the true nature of reality is something that can be known?
I don't know. What do you mean by known?
Well, I'm just doing the logical conclusion of what Pete and Brent said, is that ignorance is not knowing the nature of reality. And so therefore, I think Buddhism talks about overcoming ignorance with wisdom, right? And so wisdom is knowing the true nature of reality.
But it's non-dual wisdom.
It's non-dual wisdom. So you can know
in
you can know in a special way. You can know without knowing.
Yeah.
Sort of.
I suppose that there's that first type of wisdom.
But is there an object to that knowing?
A what?
An object that is known?
Not the ultimate knowing. I mean,
the ultimate knowing has no object?
Yeah, I suppose that the true wisdom in the path of seeing does not have an object.
The true wisdom in the path of seeing does not have an object. Anyone else? But
before that, it does.
What's the definition of a thing? That it produces, it functions.
Yes.
It can be known,
effects.
Right? It can be known.
So enlightenment is not a thing.
Enlightenment is not a thing. How can overcoming ignorance have any impact? How can it change the situation? Is there something that's known, and does that knowing produce a function? It causes enlightenment. Is that the cause of enlightenment? Knowing the nature of reality results in enlightenment, or the liberation from suffering?
Yes. It's the same thing.
Enlightenment is the liberation from suffering.
Yeah.
And so knowing the true nature of reality in a very special way produces enlightenment, right? Results in enlightenment. Causes enlightenment. That's what many of the prasangikas say, that emptiness and the true nature of reality is a thing, because it can be known.
By who? By a sentient being.
Yeah, that's the next question, right? So, anyone else, what is ignorance? What are we ignorant of?
Believing what you think is real.
Believing that what you think is real. What about what you see?
Or see.
Or see.
Or hear.
Or hear.
Or touch.
Or touch. Or taste.
What's your perception?
Whatever you experience. Believing that whatever you experience is real. That's cool. So that's ignorance, which is ignorance is not knowing the true nature of reality. And the true nature of reality, is that, are these related? Or are you guys saying, like, the true nature of reality is that all those things don't exist?
Right.
When you no longer believe that things exist. There could be two ways of looking at that, though. One way is not believing that things exist means knowing that they don't exist, or it can mean just not believing that they exist. As you know,
yeah.
right? Non-applicative negation and applicative negation,
yeah.
Right?
Just not knowing.
Yeah.
I mean, knowing they don't exist.
Not believing
them.
Not having a belief that things exist.
But they still function.
Yeah, we'll get that comes later, I think. Okay, let's see what these guys, the two tenant brothers. Yeah, the two. Oh, the nerds. Preston and Kozors, right? Danny and Craig. What is ignorance?
Are they alive people?
They are, yeah, I've met.
Are they
in Virginia? They were in Virginia, yeah. They're from the Virginia School of Jeffrey Hawkins. Why do we suffer and die? Starting on page 22 on the right hand side. Because we don't understand ourselves and our world. Okay. The next paragraph. It's important to keep in mind, ignorance with which we are concerned is not a lack of knowledge. It's not like my ignorance of Swahili. It is bad knowledge or misknowledge or misunderstanding. A misconception is ignorance. Going to what Mary Beth said, the belief that things exist. To some degree, our ignorances are of our own making, since we've been taught to believe in a false kind of existence. I don't know if that's us or the people that taught us, but if he's trying to present there's one type of ignorance, which is acquired. Buddhism indicts many of the non-Buddhist schools, by extension the world's largest religions, are indicted. We have our lawyer here, he's done the indicting, that's right. For teaching that there's a soul, an inner self that's unchanging, independent of whatever's going on in our minds and bodies, and is singular. That's what you experience when you meditate, right? You center, you find that peaceful inner core that's unruffled by the world. Isn't that what we do when we meditate?
It's different than what they call the soul. Soul, I think from what I remember of Catholicism, soul has some boundary and identity. And we're talking about core awareness. It doesn't have either.
Cool. The soul in Christianity has some boundary and entity-ness.
Identity-ness.
Yeah. Let's see.
And it's the one that accumulates karma.
There you go. They would say the soul is accumulates the negative and positive deeds, right? That's what you bring with you to the judgment at death, right?
Solves everything.
Soul. Let's see. However, these sorts of ideas, next paragraph, are artificial, they're constructions, ideas that must come to us from the outside. Although they're very not helpful, no Buddhist school regards them as being the real cause of our suffering, which is a level of misconception that is significantly more subtle and much more insidious, since it comes to us naturally. It is innate. Ignorance. So two levels of ignorance, acquired, intellectually acquired ignorance, or culturally acquired ignorance. It's not just from like studying philosophy, it's just from like living in the world and developing habit patterns that are based on dualistically viewing the world as separate from oneself and that as if things existed. And then there's the innate conception that something exists. That all beings, civilized, uncivilized, big, small, large, round, animals, fish, all of them, they have this innate ignorance.
So
even insects.
They were born with innate ignorance?
Yes.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, ignorance is not therefore fundamentally a matter of taking the wrong stance or having an incorrect philosophical position. It's a universal problem of the tutored and the untutored alike. So we'll look into it below. This innate ignorance, we'll look into it, but all of them involve the concept with regard to a person or thing that there's something that independently is that person or that thing. The essence of it, the true reality of it, or whatever, which then may be conceived in different relationships to mind and body and phenomena, or to parts, the parts of a thing. Put it another way, they all involve something other than that, other than what wisdom understands, which is that nothing has that sort of independent existence.
What do they deny that it's interdependent? What do they say? They keep saying it's in, there's something that independently is that person. What about that it's interdependently that person?
So, right. So ignorance is thinking that there's something independently that person. And wisdom is realizing that all there is dependently arisen phenomena.
Okay. So they would
the phenomena part is sketchy.
Yeah.
Let's see. And then he uses the metaphor of peachiness. Right? Peachy keen. All of the Buddhist schools, other than our school, has some level of reification or peachiness. Skipping a couple of paragraphs, the following table shows the major misconceptions and the harm that the various schools think they do, those misconceptions. It is arranged in terms of how they prevent liberation from suffering, on the one hand, or liberation of the mind from its obstructions through omniscience, Buddha. Once the elimination of those labeled subtle, only the elimination of those obstructions that are called subtle will change one's status in samsara from being chained or bound in samsara to being liberated from samsara. But dealing with the coarse conceptions may be an important step towards uprooting the subtle ones. So that's the beginning for part. Who's dealing with the coarse obstruction. Okay, so let's look at, we have a perception, an obstructiveness, and a school. So first we have the permanent, single, independent person. And this is a coarse obstruction to a liberation. So we use this phrase all the time, that the self is permanent, or continuous, it's single, and it's independent, as a description for the false belief in a self. Now that's the outer version of selfness that is ignorance. It doesn't actually bind us to samsara. It's a coarse obstruction to a liberation. And uprooting that misconception, that artificial, it's an artificial or acquired misconception. It's not the innate misconception. It has too much sophistication to it. Continuous, single, independent, has too much conceptuality to it. It's not really the one that binds us to samsara. And so this is held to be a coarse obstruction to liberation, and all schools, only the prasangika makes this distinction that it's an artificial or acquired conception or obstruction. Then there's this thing called the self-sufficient person. Self-sufficient, and that's a coarse obstruction to liberation and prasangika. However, it's in the other schools, it's considered a subtle obstruction to liberation. All other schools from our school, from our prasangika school, believe that the self as being self-sufficient is the subtle obstruction to liberation, that obstruction that keeps us from being liberated from samsara. And
what do you mean by sufficient?
Yeah, so we're going to come back to the handout. It's on self-sufficient.
No.
Phenomena are naturally the bases of names. Subject and object are different entities. And so this is a sort of a subtlety, to use an overused word here currently, of the Chittamatra tradition, which is not that important to our understanding of the basic trend. Subjects, so that's considered the obstruction to full Buddhahood in the Chittamatra. That's considered to be the final obstruction. So for the Chittamatra, they have the obstruction to liberation is the self-sufficient person, and they have the obstruction to omniscience is thinking that phenomena are naturally the bases of names, and that subject and object are different entities. We'll skip the next one. True existence is considered a subtle obstruction to omniscience in the Svatantrika. So an obstruction to omniscience is an obstruction to Buddhism, not to liberation. And the difference between true existence and the next one, inherent existence, subtle is very subtle. But for Prasangikas, the subtle obstruction to liberation is basically the same as the obstruction to omniscience in the Svatantrika, if this makes any sense. So the Svatantrika take all of the other like subtleties of obstructions and move them down a notch. They like say, well, you didn't get really the real thing that binds us to samsara, or that's the real type of ignorance. And so they get very snotty or arrogant about their description of ignorance far surpasses all the others. And so finally, for the Prasangikas, the two obstructions are the belief in inherent existence, and that's the subtle obstruction to liberation. So that's what causes bondage and samsara. And the appearance of inherent existence, the stains of conceiving the two truths as different entities, is the subtle obstruction to Buddhahood or omniscience in the Prasangika. So let's briefly walk through some of these that are more helpful. In particular, let's look at the self-sufficient person. What the hell is a self-sufficient person? On the next page, page 24 on the left, it says, this is the conception of a self that is not only permanent and unitary, which is the self that is permanent, indivisible, and independent. The self-sufficient person, this is the conception of a self that is not only permanent and unitary, but is the boss of the mind and body. It's in charge. That this self is self-sufficient means that it can appear to the mind without depending on any other object. That it can appear to our minds without depending on mind and body. So it's sufficient in itself. It doesn't need any other basis of designation. But the obstruction to liberation in most of the schools is thinking that there is some real self that exists in some indescribable way that's related but not the same as the aggregates. And that's for all of the schools except Prasangika is the obstruction to liberation. Thinking that there is some indescribable self. And that's what I believe we all ascribe to. That we all believe there's some self, and we change our definition of it moment by moment. You know, it's related to my body when I bump my foot, and it's related to my mind when I'm insulted, and it just sort of floats around. It gets bigger, it gets smaller, and it's definitely there. And I know that sense of self. It's there. I can touch it. Right? It's self-sufficient.
We're creating.
I'm trying to.
No, I mean, all the time. You know, something that doesn't jive with what we experienced 5 minutes ago, so then we sort of like try to fit it in.
Yeah, that's the self-sufficient self. And so let's skip to here, true existence on the right-hand side.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, so this is... Again, this is a subtler level of obstruction or obstacle to something, either liberation or omniscience. And here is the conception that applies to all phenomena, not just persons. It is that any phenomena has what we might call pointable existence.
That's a terrible way to describe it.
You don't like that, pointable?
Pointable, you think of a finger.
Don't get confused the object for the pointer. Don't miss the moon for the finger. Wow, you walked right into that one.
Wow. Okay.
That there is something. One of the aggregates or parts, a collection, my mother, my uncle. There's something apart from them that we can be pointed to as being a phenomenon. So there's the shrine. You can point to the shrine, like, it's there. There's the shrine there. There's Peter there. There's this computer. There's space here. There's building. Don't get complicated. There's stuff there. You can't deny that things are here, right? You know, even though they don't resolve them into neat little packages of parts, particles or whatever you want to call them, there's something there. You can't walk through this shit, right? Hmm.
Yes.
Somehow the table itself is within the parts which it has made. This conception is subtler than the conception of a self-sufficient person, because it usually does not involve conceiving that there's an entity apart from the mind and body, or the basis of designation that controls them. An inherent existence. This conception also applies to all phenomena. Like the conception of true existence, we conceive of something that we can point to. However, we do not conceive of this as being anything from among the aggregates or the parts of a phenomena. Rather, the self or thing just seems to be indistinguishable from the aggregates or the parts. Just like this type of existence seems to be indistinguishable from true existence. Right? Skipping a couple of, the I or thing, this is somehow more important, but not distinguishable from that to which it is intimately related. With another phenomena such as a table, the conception is that there's some tableness that pervades the table and is its real identity. Without any conception that the table is some specific part of the table or some supernatural thingness or psychic, you know, where it's just there's a table there. This conception is innate, not something learned. So basically you have these three main levels of belief in there being something real. Or for simplicity purposes, there's these two levels. One is that the essence of something is unchanging, unitary, and independent, i.e. it's self-sufficient. You can sort of put those together for simplicity purposes. Self-sufficient is that it has its own entity. It doesn't depend on some other basis of designation for its existence. There's a self, there's an entity there. And then the more subtler version of that is pointable existence or just some thingness. That this world is real in some way. I can't describe it, but you can't deny it, you know? So those are the two levels of belief in the reality that are ignorance, that make up the types of ignorance. Ignorance of outer ignorance that binds one to samsara, keeps one from liberation. So liberation is liberation from samsara, i.e. the first bhumi or the path of seeing. And then the second one, when you overcome the instructions to omniscience, and thereby become close to a Buddha. And the little difference is this last little one on the bottom of page 24 on the right, where it says, as stated, the appearance of inherent existence, as stated, this includes the stains of conceiving the two truths as different entities. So we've been doing this for so many kalpas that it produces this really deeply ingrained habit pattern that even after you've uprooted the attachment to samsara by uprooting the belief in a self-sufficient person, and even if you've uprooted the belief in true or inherent existence, there's still the habit the residue of the habit patterns that still is in your being. So when you're outside of the meditation of equipoise, you still see things as if it's subject and object. When you're in equipoise, you're completely beyond subject-object experience. But when you come out of that meditation, until you're a Buddha, you still have this sense of there being something happening. Conceiving the two truths as different entities. Prasangas do not differentiate between what we must understand to become liberated persons, arhats, and what we must understand to become Buddhas. The conception of inherent existence is always the target. This is a little subtlety where when we talk about one-fold egolessness, two-fold egolessness, and one-and-a-half-fold egolessness, we say that there's egolessness of self or the person, egolessness of phenomena, or the two egolessnesses. And then we say, well, the second one you can divide into two parts. It has two parts to it. There's the overcoming of the belief in the reality of phenomena. And then there's the sort of arrogance, or the sort of belief that you've understood something that remains, is the way we sort of describe the second fold ignorance, is that this feeling that something has been understood or overcome. And so in some traditions, these two selves, the self of persons and the self of phenomena, are not totally affiliated with the two obstructions of kleshas and obstructions to omniscience. And we'll come back to this, but just to sort of begin to open this topic, is that the prasangika say the root of all of them is the belief in true existence. And so they say arhats and Buddhas have the same understanding, that they've uprooted the attachment to true existence. And so then how do you distinguish them? Their wisdom is the key that then needs to be refined, and we'll come back to that over time. So let's go further in the handout into what substantial existence and substantial establishment and self-sufficiency means. So first, the side with all the many words on it, not the chart. From Meditation on Emptiness by Jeffrey Hopkins, by Bhashika, also means one, who asserts that past, present, and future objects are all instances of substantial entities. So this little excerpt, before this he was saying, he's listing the different things that are substantial entities. In addition, past, present, and future are substantial entities. Further said that Vaibhashikas are so called because, like the non-Buddhist Vaisheshikas, they propound many substantially established phenomena, such as uncaused space, which other Buddhist systems say are existent, but only designated by thought. So here we have like a scheme. Could you scout out the pad there? Please, and a marker that works with dark ink on it. Please, both ultimate and conventional truths are substantially established. So in this tradition, we have substantial establishment is like the big criteria, whether something is substantially established. And there's ultimate truths that are entities that are substantially established, and also conventional ones. But the key factor is that they're all substantially established. This is the Sarvastivada. Everything exists. All the dharmas exist. The only ultimate ones are substantially existent. So there's a distinction between the conventional truths, conventional substantially established entities, and ultimate substantially established entities. And that ultimate substantially established entities are also really existent. The ultimate ones really exist. So something is substantially existent, it's able to be seen, and it's able to perform a function, it's able to be there's no more pad.
Well, I can't use the floor, but you want to hang it up here or something?
That'd be great. So these guys are the only school to differentiate substantially established and substantially existent. The intention being to provide a status of substantiality for conventional truths, to make the conventional truths feel good. We give them some status of being real, but they're not quite as real as ultimate realities. So though conventional truths are imputedly existent, they are substantially established because in these systems, these imputations are true. So conceptual phenomena are true, are substantially established. Conceptual phenomena are not sufficient, are not substantially existent. So when objects designated are sought, an autonomous entity is found. So then the next guy tries to explain this bizarre language to us a little bit more. In general, there's four ways of asserting substantial existence. Not substantial establishment. So substantial existence in the sense of being stable and unchanging. This includes only static, unconditioned phenomena. Bases of existence. Four.
Skandhas?
Five. It's a mapping of a skandha. So what's the one on the left usually? When we group all the 75 dharmas into five groups.
Form. Matter?
Form. Matter, right?
Chandra.
Yeah, matter. Or, yeah.
Matter.
Matter. So it's on the back side here. You have the little chart on the bottom. You have forms. And then the next one is mind, the different types of mind. And then you have mental factors.
MF, okay?
Yeah, MF. And then you have naps. Non-associated phenomena.
Formations?
Formations, sorry. Phenomena spelled with a PH, right? And then what's in the fifth box? It's here on the chart, right? Mm-hmm.
But there's only four. Here.
That's on the bottom level. It's on the next level up on the left. Group five.
How subjects engage objects?
No. Next
one
row.
Existence?
Uncreated things
on the left. Three dharmas, group five, right? So those are the five. So, of these, which of them are impermanent of those five groups?
All of them? Oh, not the uncreated.
Not the uncreated, right. The first four are impermanent, right? And the fourth one is permanent, not in the sense of eternal, as one of the authors went through, right? But in the sense of continuing, right? So draw a box around the first four. Earth, yeah, impermanence.
Yeah?
Yeah. Imper. Infirm.
This one is in the, why is it?
The fifth one, uncreated phenomena are permanent, right?
In the sense of what?
In the sense that they don't disintegrate every moment.
Oh.
So here, this guy says, in general, there are four ways of asserting substantial existence. And he's describing what the other guy said in the second paragraph up top, where he says both ultimate and conventional truth. So which of these are ultimate of these five groups? Which are ultimate?
Uncreated.
The uncreated, group five is ultimate, right?
Yeah.
The uncreated, yeah.
ultimate?
Yeah, ultimate, below. That one's ultimate. That has nirvana in it and cessation, right? And the rest is conventional. The other four are conventional, right? And then all five of them, like put it like a thing underneath, show that all five groups,
like
a bowstring, like a bracket, that would be cool.
Like that?
Yeah, perfect. And then put here, substantially established, right? So it says both ultimate and conventional truths are substantially established. All of that stuff is substantially established. Some people say real, but all of these are real. These are real phenomena. Sarvastivada, they exist. All of this is real, substantially established. And then he says in the next part of the first sentence of the second paragraph, he says the only ultimate ones are substantially existent. So only the ultimate ones, so permanent, uncreated, ultimate, and substantially existent means truly real.
Why, how can they be substantially existent? What does that mean? I mean,
okay, what does substantial existence mean? Thank you, John. So underneath on the bottom, he says, in general, there are four ways of asserting substantial existence. So, but just before we dive into that, the key thing is that only ultimate substantially established phenomena are substantially existent. So there's real phenomena that are existent and non-existent. This is the hardest thing, is that they're going to use this language, that there's real non-existent phenomena. Just saying.
Real but non-existent.
Real but non-existent, okay? Just messing with you. In general, there are four ways of asserting substantial existence. One, substantial existence in the sense of being stable and unchanging, i.e. permanent, right? That if it's permanent, then it's substantial existence. This includes only static, permanent, unaffected phenomena, i.e. the unconditioned over here. That's one sense. Substantial existence in the sense of being able to perform a function. Sense of being able to perform a function. This includes only non-static, impermanent phenomena, conditioned phenomena, the first four groups, right? Substantial existence in the sense of being established logically. This includes all existent phenomena. This is all existent phenomena is all five groups. This is also known as substantial existence established by being the object of valid cognition. So valid cognition can only have substantially existent and established objects. I'm sorry, I'm like heading off into outer space here with this, partially because these two authors are talking about different things I'm realizing. Lastly, substantial existence in the sense of being self-sufficient is the last one. So self-sufficiently, substantially existent. This includes only forms of physical phenomena and ways of being aware of something. So substantial existence in the sense of being self-sufficient includes ultimate realities. Ultimate realities in this tradition are partless particles and partless moments of consciousness. And so those are actually ultimate realities in this system. These guys, they're not totally using the same terminology. Let's see, all Buddhist tenets agree that only self-sufficient, substantial existence Oh, it gets worse, doesn't it? Self-sufficiently substantially established is the alternative terminology that the earlier schools, i.e. in particular the Vaibhashikas, are using to talk about relative and ultimate truth. Where we just say ultimate and relative truth, they don't talk in that language. They talk about this idea of substantially established or existent. And the nuance is that they consider naps, non-associated formations, what we saw earlier as duration, attainment, arising, abiding, passing away, time, space, all of these things which we consider conceptual ideas, they consider them to be as real as all the other stuff. But they don't consider them to be substantially, they consider them to be real, but somehow they're a little bit less provable than all the others. So somehow, even though we have all these different, these categories and these different ways of looking at them, somehow these have a slightly lesser status. And this becomes this group becomes the object of attack in the next school, in the South Tantricas. And then each school will go on and like attack different groups of these, right? And undermine their reality until you get to the Prasangas, which undermines the true existence of any of them, right?
But not their function. Prasangika still believe that all this stuff is functioning, right?
But there's no entity that's functioning. And the other ones still have, like, so the Sautantikas get rid of this guy. They X that, they next that guy. And then the Chittamatrans next that guy, right? Matter. But doesn't exist, right? And then the Sautantikas, Svatantrika and Yamaka, they mix these two guys. And they sort of have a, what you might say, a substantially existent, uncreated. And then the Prasangikas mix these guys. But the first one to go is these. And so there's, in some sense, these are all dharmas. And for Vaibhashikas, all dharmas are real. And these are like objectively experienced. And the fact that these can't be objectively experienced as an independent entity, you know, this is like arising or duration or wastage or attainment or possession. There's also weird stuff in here like gender and numbers and syllables and words and weird conceptual things that we normally think of as things that interact with these other things. But they view them as having the same reality status, but they weren't observable in the same ways. Yeah, they don't, you know, you can't, they don't have pointable existence. We can't all point to the same, you know, abroad, you know, law of the way matter works. And so that was their only failing, was they were not, in one of these guys' definitions, they're not self-sufficiently, substantially established, in that they don't have an independent of either mental or physical existence that you can sort of objectively experience. But they're still real things. They just have that one little failing, and it's not really, it doesn't change the sort of reality status of their world. There's, you know, it's like pure forms almost, in like Platoism. And then the Svatantra, because, you know, they just totally dispense with that. That's the next one. Anyway, I'll try to get the terminology right next time. Here's on the back here you have a little chart, which is one way of viewing. This is like the Vaibhashika way of viewing, is that there's real phenomena, reality, and within that there's existent things and non-existent things. And don't let the different uses of these words be too confusing. In this case, non-existent things are there's things like unicorns and jackalopes, but what's the main non-existent thing that's like the big thing that they all talk about in Buddhism endlessly that's non-existent?
Permanent self?
A self.
Oh, self.
Oh, is that not what you said? I'll give you a benefit. A self. A self is like the main non-existent thing, right? Then there's existent things, all these other things. Objects, subjects, how they engage. There's the uncreated phenomenon. Nirvana is an existent thing, and there's this notion that ignorance does not understand nirvana, and wisdom is the cognition of nirvana or emptiness or selflessness, and that has an entity to it. And because it's a thing, it has an effect, which is uprooting ignorance.
And where is wisdom in this?
Wisdom is sort of in the uncreated things, nirvana.
Uncreated things regardless?
Yeah, so there's nirvana, and then there's two types of cessation. There's cessation that's, in here, in the Vaibhashika space is one of the three, and then there's cessation by uprooting ignorance, and then there's cessation as in the petering out of the productive forces of anything, like the cessation of a fire, literally. Just the element, the wood gets burned up, and so there's the cessation of the fire. So that's one type of cessation. And the other type is by uprooting ignorance.
So self doesn't exist, but wisdom does?
Right.
So it's the wisdom that sees the...
That sees a real thing, it sees...
Not self, but they still think the wisdom is...
Is real, totally. And then you have created things are the other 72 dharmas, when there's a 75 dharma, scheme, forms, primary mind. Usually, sometimes there's six primary minds in other versions. And then you have the mental factors, which in their world is 46, not 51. Anyway, sorry for the substantial confusion. Thank you very much. I guess, you know, the takeaway then is that as we go through Vaibhashika and Svatantrika, these guys are going to use these odd terms, substantially existent, substantially established, and I'll try to get them right soon. But know that they basically refer to whether somehow they're trying to exclude naps from one of them. You know, naps are either not substantially established or they're not self-sufficient, depending on how they're using the terminology.
What did you say, naps?
Naps, the non-associated formation.
Oh, right.
Anyway, questions?
Yeah.
quite late. Sorry about that.
Sounds like a French in the military.
By this merit,
may defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings.
By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east,
may the lotus garden of the victim's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy the profound.